Is that really a significant change?
Okay, I'm going to call this meeting to order. Stand Sarah Board. We'll start with the roll call.
Darren Garrett.
Present.
Mike Lynch.
Here, way back over here.
You need to come over here. You're president for life.
Sam Sharp.
Here.
Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Jeff Grover. Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Jeff Manger.
Here.
Mandeep Dillon.
Here.
Rhonda Biesmeyer.
Here.
We have a quorum.
I thought Lynch was going to be chairman for life.
I declined.
Hey, do we have any announcements?
I do have some announcements. First, I would like to announce the rotation of officers pursuant to bylaw section 1.5. Trustee Jim DeMartini is chair for the 2019 Board of Retirement, and Trustee Sam Sharp is vice chair. I also would like to announce that the education reports that I promised you for this meeting are slightly delayed. We're going to a new format where it'll be singular, just your own, and those will be viewable on the web where your stats are currently now. So there's too much data to be held in the format that we were now. Also, they don't have to be approved in a board setting like this, but I will be getting them to you so that you can make sure they're accurate before we get them posted online. So I hope to have those to you before February's meeting. Lastly, I would like to ask that if you have any, if you haven't filled out your 700 form, to please do so. And then if you have any difficulties, because this is the first year that it's rolled out completely electronic, for some of you did it electronically last year, but your notifications and everything went out in the electronic format. If you have any difficulties, just let us know. We can help you, or the clerk of the board can help you. So that's all I have.
Okay, we'll now move to public comment period. Any comments from the public? Nothing? Okay, seeing none, we'll go to consent calendar. Any member of this board wish to pull an item from consent for further discussion? Seeing none, I'll entertain a motion for approval.
Chairman, I move that we adopt the consent calendar as noted on the agenda.
Okay, is there a second?
Second.
Okay, motion has been made and seconded. We approve the consent calendar. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion's carried unanimously. We will now move to agenda item 6, flash report.
And we have Ed Hoffman, who's going to be attending by conference call.
Who?
Ed Hoffman from Barrett's. He just has
this item 6 came in awfully late.
It just came in today.
Go right ahead. Good afternoon,
everyone. Good afternoon. Good.
Hi.
Happy 2019. I take it we're at the flash report in the agenda?
That's correct.
According to your flash report, it's not a happy 2019.
So. Well, it wasn't a happy 2018, I'll give you that. So, taking a look at the flash report, the top line, we have the total fund negative 3.1% for the month of December. Modestly outperforming policy index at negative 3.3. That brings the calendar year to date to negative 4.4. So that is the full 2018 number there, negative 4.4, versus policy index of negative 3.9. And then you can see the fiscal year to date numbers as well. I would like to note, though, that all of these numbers, given that it's through December 31st, we don't have the private markets, the closed-end funds, in here yet, and we would hope that that would be a net positive to the total plan, but we'll have those numbers later on. So, you know, just always have to keep that in mind, that we're missing about 11% of the assets in this number. Looking down through the asset classes, we see the pretty dramatic pullback in U.S. equities, which was really driven a lot by the discussion by the Fed. And so various comments by Chairman Powell had us zigging and zagging and zigging and zagging throughout the quarter and even into early 2019. And so that change in outlook and perspective has crept into these numbers. And it's interesting because a lot of that has to do with commentary rather than actual Fed decision or any change in the numbers or expected numbers. So now we're seeing a different tenor from the Fed in terms of what we expect and what the market expects in 2019 as a result of that. But 2018, they successfully raised rates 4 times, and that had a lot to do with the pullback we see in domestic equities here for the month of December. International equities also pulled back, though not quite as much, so a negative 4.8 for the month. And we can see that piled on to what was already a challenging year for international equities, bringing them down almost 16%. Fixed income, the ballast in our portfolio provided the support we hope and want, so generating a positive 1.2% there. And that, you know, I'd like to remind everyone that includes both the price action of the bonds as well as the yield. And we're mostly focused on the yield because that yield is what we look to generate the positive 2-3% returns. And these are largely buy and hold strategies. So that's additive here against the price action of the bonds. And on page 2, we take a look at real estate, and the only real numbers we have here are the BlackRock real estate REIT down 8.6%, and REITs do tend to trade like small cap equities, and the sell-off in domestic equities ties almost directly to what we're seeing here in the REIT space. And so we continue to try to lighten our exposure to REITs as we build out the longer-term private real estate positions. Then we have the direct lending with no stated numbers there, and then risk parity, doing a little bit more of what we hired it to do, where it did not pull back as much as the broader market or as much as what we have it benchmarked to here in terms of a 60-40 portfolio, as the pullback in equity markets was partially offset by the increase in pricing of the bonds. And so that offset helped it perform a little bit better. And then infrastructure and other private markets exposure that we have there. So overall, as we take a look at the right-hand side of the page, then we are slightly underweight domestic equity, more underweight international equity, domestic fixed income, a little bit overweight there, real estate and alternatives. So in times like this, we could look at this as an opportunity to rebalance the portfolio, take some from domestic equity and allocate it with a 1.3% overweight. That might create an opportunity now. The markets have shifted since this time, though. And so I suspect that underweight to equities, overweight to fixed income isn't as pronounced as it shows on this page, because since December 31st, we've seen a pretty significant rise here in U.S. equity markets as well as international. And so as we take a look at numbers through Friday, I know these numbers aren't in front of you, but just I can give you a quick verbal update that through Friday, the S&P 500 was up about 6.6%, and likewise developed markets up about 6.5, and emerging markets up about 5.2. So 2019 is starting off a little bit better than 2018 finished, and so I would say we should keep the positions where they are. The market has sort of rebalanced a bit for us on our own, and we'll take a look at it again next month when we have those numbers.
Yeah,
I
have a question. This is Mike Lynch. The first on the direct lending, when are those numbers going to be available?
So direct lending are reported on a one-quarter lag, and so what we show in each of our quarterly reports, we only show those in the quarterly reports for the prior quarter. So when we meet in February, we'll be taking a look at fourth quarter numbers, and that fourth quarter report will include the information up through the third quarter. They always operate on a lag.
Okay. All right, here's my question. When we did the rebalancing, and we took a significant amount of money from domestic equities and channeled it to international equities and other funds, I thought that this was going to come back to us where we, in major transfers of money, we would be made aware. And did I just miss those transfers, or did I miss when we sold major domestic equity holdings and reinvested them in something else?
We've been doing that probably September, October of last year, just constantly, yeah. There was some...
But don't you remember the discussion we had here where you were going to report back to us when we were moving the money?
Yeah, I think we did. I think we told you guys when we were doing that. We had gotten into the habit of doing that early last year.
I don't.
I mean, I can check on that, but
I'd appreciate that. Okay. I'd like to see some verification of that. Okay, I'm done, Ed.
No, then any other questions? I just had one comment. You know that our domestic equity is just down to not less than 19%. We used to, have a lot more than that. I question the wisdom of having more international equity than domestic, especially if you look and see how poorly the international market is. Maybe we should think about rebalancing that and reduce our international equity and increase our U.S. equity. That is my thought.
Yeah, well, we are seeking to keep the portfolio in line with the policy. And the policy comes about from the work that we've done together. So, I'm sure you remember all of those meetings. One thing that I'd like to change for this year is to spend a little bit more time taking a deeper dive into how the assumptions are built. Because I think that's really the crux of the issue, is that when we look at the models and when we think about how we can construct a portfolio looking out 10 years, and we say, okay, these are our expected return assumptions, these are our expected volatility assumptions, these are how we expect these things to all work together, as certain things will go up and down by more and less and offset each other. Take a deeper dive into the assumptions that go into that, and then I think that'll create a better discussion about why we end up where we end up. And we revisit these annually, and so I expect that we'll do that again this year, because it'll be part of the sizing of the liquidity portfolio and thinking about the exposures that we want. So I do want to walk through that again in more detail. At this time, generally speaking, we seek to maintain exposure in line with policy unless we have a strong and agreed upon view that policy isn't right, that we should be overweight certain asset classes and underweight others. And I don't know that we have that. I mean, we aren't recommending that to any plans or to any of our clients. We're saying stick with policy right now because the uncertainty in the markets doesn't lead us to any strong conclusions one way or the other.
How about other Stan Sara groups there? Are they down as low into the U.S. equity as what we are? I mean, are we out of sync with everybody else? I never have liked the reduction of U.S. equity down to what it is, but how do we compare to other Stan Sara organizations?
You're not out of sync at all. There are many who have gone to equal weighting between U.S. and international and overweighting international, and the logic has generally been very similar across other plans, even across other consultants. And the issue is that the valuations domestically have been very high. The valuations internationally have been comparatively low. And why wouldn't you want to capture that? And so it factors into those capital market assumptions that show, gosh, it looks like there are higher expected returns internationally than domestically. And as we seek to get a 7 or 7.25% return, we got to go where the returns look like they are, and those tend to be international markets on the equity side, as well as the private markets, which we've talked about quite a bit over the past several months.
Well, I don't know what it is you're looking at, but I'm looking at the international equities. It's 15.8% year-to-date reduction. I think it's one of the worst investments we have. I don't know what it is you're looking at that thinks it's so good.
Rick, is there an easy-to-get chart of the 20 counties that are broken down like this? Domestic equity, 18, is that an easy-to-get chart?
We can. I can tell you right now, almost undoubtedly, that our asset allocation is very similar to almost everybody else's. One of the things we can also do is look at the RV Kuhn study, and we can see how folks are allocated that way. But we can put together something that shows you how our asset allocation compares to other systems.
Can you do sure. that? I don't mean a big, giant amount of work, but you know, we have six categories, and most of the other funds probably have six similar categories.
Yeah, and I can tell you one of the best pieces of anecdotal evidence for the homogeneity across asset allocations is the returns that we're achieving. They're fairly tight. There's not a huge range of returns that these 37X systems are achieving across the board. So that tells me that our asset allocations at the core are very similar.
And how about the CalPERS stuff? Is their allocation similar?
I would suggest they are very similar as well, too.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, I don't see any.
Thank you, Ed.
Yes, I'll remain on the line, but I'm going to go on mute.
Okay,
it looks like we have nothing under item 7 in the packet, so this will move to agenda item 8A.
So this is the preliminary findings from the June 30th, 2018 actuarial evaluation experience study. This is a discussion and action item, and later today staff will be recommending option 1, which is lowering the discount rate from 7.25% to 7%, lowering the inflation assumption from 3% to 2.75%, lower the retiree COLA assumption from 2.7 to 2.6, and maintaining the real wage growth assumption at 0.25%. Also, we'll be asking you to implement all the other demographic assumption changes that have been revealed in the triennial experience study. And with that, I will turn this over to our system actuary, Graham Schmidt.
Hey, all. Good to see you. It's funny, for a change, I get to be the bearer of good news. When does that ever happen? Although good news is also tied to the mortality tables, which isn't good news for everybody. Anyway, so what we're going to cover is the slide 1. We'll talk a little bit about the preliminary 2018 valuation results. So I'm going to talk about what we've seen between last year and this year before we talk about any assumption changes, what happened. And then I'll get into a little bit of review of the demographic assumptions, but the bulk of that presentation will come to you the next meeting when we give you the full experience study report. I'm just going to summarize our findings. What I really want to focus on today is the discussion of the economic assumptions, because that's where you all tend to have the most input and direction for us, and I'd like to get that from you today if possible. And then we'll just talk about what the next steps are. But if you jump to slide 2, here's our summary of the key valuation results from last year to this year. These results are preliminary, so they're still going our peer review process. And these are based on the current assumptions, so these will change once we've adopted final assumptions. But if we use the same assumptions as last year, including the 7.25% discount rate, you'll see that the funded ratio improved by about a percent from 74.3 to 75.4. That's on the smooth value of assets. Also, if you just look at the market value of assets, it also improved by about a percent from 74.5 to 75.5%. And the other good piece of news is that the employer contribution rate actually declined from 31.65 to 31.11% of pay. So about a half a percent of pay reduction in the employer contribution rate. Okay. Turn to the next slide. We'll talk about why did these things change. Well, first of all, your return on the market value of assets, and this is through June 30th of 18, so not reflecting all the stuff you were just talking about, was 7.8% net of investment expenses. So that compares to the 7.25% assumption. We do asset smoothing, right? So we look at investment gains or losses over a five-year period and smooth them out so you don't see jumps in, up and down in the employer contribution rate. But even on a smooth basis, you earned 7.9% because your deferred gains and losses were basically offsetting each other. So your return on assets was 7.9 on a smooth basis. That gives you over $12 million gain, and that decreased the contribution rate by about a third of a percent of pay. Remember, the employer is the one that benefits from investment gains, just like they have to fund the additional cost of investment losses. The employee's assumption contributions only change when you make changes to the assumptions or the PEPRA plan population changes. So the fiscal year 17-18 contribution that the employer made was actually a little less than the actuarial cost. And the reason for that is, I don't know if you remember, a few years ago when we implemented some assumption changes, you phased in the impact of those assumption changes. So because there was a phase in, the contribution last year was still slightly below the actuarial cost. That shortfall was a little over $5 million, and that means that the contribution went up by 0.16%. That was the last year of the phase-in, so we shouldn't see that issue going forward, assuming that the costs are fairly level over time. Impact of everything else, if you jump to the next slide, was pretty minimal. So it was a decrease in the contribution rate of about another third of a percent of pay. We did have some demographic losses on salary increases and the retiree COLA increases higher than expected. We have been assuming that long-term the COLAs would increase by 2.7%. You got the full 3% last year, so there was a loss there. And is it okay for me to give an update on the COLA? The CPI for the Bay Area actually went up by over 4% in the last year, so you're going to see another 3% COLA this year. So there'll be a loss there next year. That is offset by a reduction in the employer normal cost rate by about 0.2% because of PEPRA employees, right? The PEPRA employees are paying a larger share of their normal cost. So as your legacy tier is replaced by your PEPRA tier, you should see a decline in the overall employer normal cost rate, okay? And then your payroll actually grew by more than your assumption. Your assumption is that payroll grows by 3.25% each year. It grew by more than 5%. Part of the basic pay increases were pretty close to expected, but you actually had an increase in the active population. That doesn't have an impact on the dollar amount of the contribution, but it does lower it as a percentage of pay because you're taking that UAL payment and you're spreading it out over a larger payroll base than we had assumed, right? So it doesn't mean you're going to have to contribute more or less in dollar terms, but it just means that the county and the other employers spread that contribution out over a larger salary base, so it lowers the rate. That's it. I mean, that's what happened from last year to this year in terms of the cost. We are down to an 18-year amortization period, so there's no negative amortization. You are making a payment, a principal payment, towards the unfunded liability this year. But if you jump to slide 5, this really summarizes everything in terms of what were the cost rate, what was the total contribution rate built of the normal cost, the UAL rate, and the administrative expenses, and how did that get from last year to this year. So I'm happy to answer any questions on the results so far. I mean, one of the good things about this report is it's boring, and that's what we like to see when it comes to the actuarial valuation, right? No big surprises.
Are there any questions so far? Okay. Continue on, then.
So we'll come back at the next meeting with a full experience study book where we break out all of, you know, what's happened over the last 3 years. Remember, the experience study is where we look back over the last 3 years, compare our assumptions to what has actual experience looked like, tweak any of the assumptions that we think are necessary to make better predictions about future experience. When we're doing the demographic assumptions, so things like retirement rates, termination, mortality, we're looking at your experience. We're going to look at what is your most recent 3 years look like, how does that compare to our assumptions. For the economic assumptions, that's when we're looking forward, right? You're not going to make your assumption negative 8% because you lost 8% on your assets next year, you know, last year. So that's more of a forward-looking exercise. But for demographic assumptions, the best evidence we have is the information on what people are doing now. So I'm just summarizing the changes that we will be recommending in that report. The biggest changes are going to be in mortality. This is always the good news, bad news. Your actual experience has looked fairly similar to the CalPERS assumptions. So CalPERS published, they're big enough that they can publish their own tables, and we've compared your tables to their tables. We did last time, and we adopted those tables 3 years ago. Your experience still looks fairly similar. We're recommending some slight adjustments to the male and female rates, but overall it looks pretty close. What has changed is the actuarial profession publishes these tables about how do they expect mortality to improve in the future. And they're not to the point where they're proposing that there's not going to be no improvement in the future, but the projections are based partly on what has recent experience looked like, and then sort of blending towards some long-term average that mortality improves by 1% per year in the future. Well, the last few years have shown a pretty significant slowing in the rate of improvement. People are still living longer, but they're not living longer as quickly, right? Which means that when we do these projections, we assume, you know, slower improvement in mortality going forward, and that ends up actually resulting in a reduction in your contributions. So if we implement the assumptions that we're proposing, it would actually reduce the total cost, that's employee plus employer, by over 1.5% of pay. And this is a new thing for me. I've never done that as part of an actual experience study where I'm proposing mortality assumptions, which actually will lower cost. But I think it's a great outcome, and it's because of the fact that a few years ago we really stepped up these, we went to remember generational improvements in mortality. So now it's, rather than always saying that, you know, every time we update these assumptions, it's going to increase cost, now, hopefully, the answer is, this is our best estimate right now, and next time I come back, it may be higher, it may be lower, but I'm not expecting it's going to be higher like it used to be with the old methodologies.
So we're dying more frequently than you thought we would?
No, but I don't think you're going to be getting healthier and healthier as quickly as I thought you were last time around.
All right.
I had one question about those assumptions. For the mortality, is this based on the county employees or as a population and as a whole?
So we have two different parts of the assumption. We have what are your base tables like today? How quickly do we what's the rate of likelihood of death of somebody who's going to turn 60 this year? Those assumptions, we take a large-scale table. In this case, we look at the CalPERS table. We compare your actual experience of your members to that table, and we say, you know what, you're living on average a little bit longer, a little bit, you know, less long than those base tables, and we're going to take those tables and we're going to adjust them slightly. And your members have been pretty close to the CalPERS general experience. The assumption that's more of a society-wide one is about how do we expect mortality to improve in the future. We can't really come up with an assumption about an individual employer, how much healthier are their employees going to get over the next 20 to 50 years. For that, we really rely on large-scale assumptions about, you know, that derive from, like, Social Security data. What do, you know, people who are experts in this think is going to happen over the long term? So for our assumptions about improvements in the future, that's sort of U.S.-wide. For assumptions about right now, we look at your plan behavior.
That's mostly for us there, because I would think that the county employees are probably more healthy than the public in general. With all our drug addiction and all the problems we have, there, we won't find that in county employees.
In general, anybody who's in a is in a pension plan generally has lower mortality, i.e. they're healthier than the U.S.-wide population.
I was just going to ask you that. Is there, like, numbers that show public employees versus others?
Actually, that's a great question. The Society of Actuaries this morning released their final version of a study for the first time on public plan mortality.
Okay.
So the tables that have been used in the past, a lot of them were based on private sector mortality. They excluded public sector data. With the public sector tables, it does appear that public sector employees on average live a little bit longer than private sector. But mostly, the biggest difference is for teachers. Teachers live forever. A long time.
They live for a long time.
The difference isn't as great with you know, generals.
They sure don't believe that. I'm married to a teacher.
That could just be your experience.
Why there's a... I could get into joint and survivor. Factors, but that's going to be a horrible
joke. So public employees live longer?
Slightly. Okay. And the difference between, there is a difference between public safety and general. That public safety still lives a little, not quite as long as general. However, we looked at using these tables for you guys and decided it wasn't worth the change because CalPERS is probably more similar to you to begin. CalPERS does produce their own tables, mm-hmm. and your experiences look pretty much like CalPERS. So there's no reason to switch to a U.S.-wide public sector table when you've got CalPERS tables that look like they're matching your experience pretty well.
And they have a large enough membership, right?
They do.
Remember, our experience is not just the employee that retired, but we're looking at how long are we paying out the benefit.
Right.
Yep.
How long is the liability? Future. Because the employee may have passed away early.
And there's a spouse
or
a kid.
But the spouse or whoever is Dependent. The designated beneficiary yeah. could live beyond. So you're looking at both.
Right. You know. And actually what's interesting is we don't even care too much about how many people are living and dying. What we look at is the amount of the benefits. Because
right.
I don't know if you remember last time we presented this, we measure these things based on the benefit amounts, not based on the number of people dying, because people with larger benefits tend to live longer. So you could accurately, you know, you could guess correctly at the number of people dying, but you might underestimate your liabilities because the people with the higher benefits are living longer and people with lower benefits aren't. So we weight these things based on benefit amounts, not even numbers of people. But we do still weight them by male and female because there's definitely a difference there. Shrinking. The difference is shrinking.
Yeah.
If we're approaching an inflection point, do you see that at some point in the future there could be a decline in mortality?
I sure hope not. But if that happens, you'll have actuarial gains.
Yay!
Remember, you asked the question.
But does the data point to that? Actuarially?
So, you know, we use these assumptions to project mortality behavior for somebody hired today at age 25.
Sure.
I think it's reasonable to assume that that 25-year-old is going to live longer than somebody who's 75 now. That's what our assumptions use. As to whether or not that's going to be true or not,
To me, if the curve is reaching an inflection point,
yeah,
that would normally be the next.
I mean, I think generally people still think that there are still going to be medical advances, right? There's still going to be things where you can improve mortality over time. We have continued to see declines in childhood mortality, right? And that has a big impact on overall life expectancy. My guess is no, we're not going to start seeing people live shorter. But,
Kristen.
Yeah, I'm not that much of an all-seeing soothsayer, right?
That's what we say you are.
I knew the answer to that.
Graham, I do have a question for you, and it is when you mentioned gender. With the state of California now offering I think on a license, three choices. Will you have to make changes to your assumptions rates based on those choices?
I don't believe so, unless it becomes, and this is also true with something like same-sex marriage within spousal, within the optional form factors, right? Until it becomes large enough that it's has a statistical impact on our projections, I don't think it's necessary. Okay. The other thing is, if we categorize somebody in one category or another, that will eventually impact the data that we see in terms of what the mortality experience is. So in essence, we adjust our assumptions anyway for who's in your data, right? That's kind of a vague answer, but I think the assumptions will adjust themselves, basically. That is the first time I've ever gotten that question, so. Okay, so that's going to be the biggest change that we see, that we recommend. Minor changes elsewhere, slightly later retirements for some groups, not much of a change. Really no change at all to the termination rate, so for people retiring before they're service eligible. We are going to recommend a higher assumption about people that are assumed to get a reciprocal benefit from CalPERS or another 37X system. That increases costs slightly, but not much. Disability rates continue to come down, and they've been coming down as long as I've been working with you, particularly for safety duty-related disabilities. We had a good conversation with Rick over the last few weeks about, traditionally we've looked at the CalPERS public agency disability tables, but your experience has tended to look more like the state safety members, and Rick had some good information about how your procedures are probably closer to those for getting state safety disabilities approved. You're a little more stringent, I think, than the public.
That's right.
Than the public agencies. So your experience has looked more like the state safety. So we're going to recommend those tables, which are lower rates of disabilities at all ages. Anything to add there?
No, that's true. Generally, the local governments that contract under CalPERS, they're the ones that make their own decisions based on their safety disabilities. Whereas we have this board, and we have our disability council, and we've instituted new processes in approving disabilities, and it seems to be working. So, I think that explains the differences there.
Okay. And then slide 7, really no other big changes. Slight modifications to the rates of salary increases that are based on merit and longevity, 5% for the first 5 years of general, which actually fits fairly well with the step increases that, mm-hmm. that are built into the contracts, right? You get 5 years of step increases, right. One per year. Right. Other recommended assumption changes, we have a terminal pay cash out for vacation cash outs. We're actually going to propose a slight reduction in those loads, and that will actually lower the member rate slightly as well. At least for that factor. I think overall they'll be going up depending on the economic assumptions. And then just a couple other tweaks here and there. But we'll come back with that full experience study document that really shows you all the data that we're using behind the recommendations at the next meeting. Okay, economic assumptions. Here's where we'd really like to get your input. Talk a little bit about background and then the assumptions that we're going to be looking at. If you go to slide 9, what we use is a building block approach. So inflation is really the foundation for all of these economic assumptions. You have your expected return, which is a nominal number, which is made up of what do you think inflation is going to be, and then what do you think you can earn above inflation, or your real rate of return. Wage growth is built up the same way. You've got inflation, and then what do you think people are going to get in terms of pay increases above inflation? That's the real wage growth. The assumptions have to be reasonable individually and in aggregate. What does that mean? Well, it means that you wouldn't use a 2% inflation assumption for building your investment return assumption, but then a 4% inflation assumption for building your wage growth, right? You want these things to be consistent in terms of the building blocks. So your current assumptions are 3% inflation, 3.25% wage growth, so that means 0.25% for real wage growth. Your COLAs, your retiree COLAs, we assume that even though they're capped at 3%, long-term they would average 2.7%. And the expected return on assets is 7.25% net of investment expenses, which gives you that 4.25% real return. Your Let's talk first about inflation, since that's the building block of all of them. It's 3. Verus uses an assumption of 2.1% over the next 10 years. Now, your assumption is longer, right? We're using this to project wage increases and COLAs for the next, 80-plus years. But if you look at historically, inflation has been higher than 2%. It's been about 4% if you look over the last 50 years. But over the last, 10 years, it's been quite low. It's been below 2%, actually only 1.4% over the last 10 years. Right, so we've been in a low inflation environment for quite some time. Go to slide 11. The markets do provide some data in terms of what the investing world thinks inflation will be. Besides what Verus has told you, you can look at the difference between TIPS and regular Treasury bonds. So sort of get the break even, that if those two things were going to earn the same amount, what would inflation have to be? It's under 2% actually right now over a 20-year period, but pretty close to 2.
Excuse me, what are TIPS?
Treasury Inflated Protection Securities.
Yeah, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, right? So they're bonds that pay off based on what inflation is.
Right, and the interest rate changes based on changes in inflation.
Okay, thank you.
So you can compare the difference between that and a regular bond, mm-hmm. and it'll tell you sort of, well, inflation would have to be X for these things to be worth the same amount of money. And that X is about 2% over the 20-year period. The Cleveland Fed publishes information on what they expect inflation to be. And this is the one that I always kind of joke about. Their job is to keep inflation at 2. It's funny that their projections always show that inflation is going to be about 2. So they do a great job in advance. But then you can also look at surveys of other professional forecasters. So slide 12, the average right now, or the 50th percentile for economic forecasters, is about 2.2. And the range is pretty tight, between 2.1 and 2.4 at the sort of 50th percentile. Public plans have had, over the last 10 years, higher inflations about assumptions than the investment markets. And one of the reasons for that is that they started, when we started this back in the early 2000s, it was like 4% was the inflation assumption. Every 3 years, you come back, you do an experience study, you look at where you are compared to the markets, you might make an adjustment part of the way there. We don't make giant changes in these assumptions, on an annual basis, whereas the investment markets can change really rapidly. So we've come down from 4 to 3. That's a pretty big change. It's just the investment markets went down a lot faster and a lot further. So we're still catching up sort of to where the investment markets are. I think people also have said, investment markets might say it's somewhere between 2 and 2.5, but 3 is still pretty reasonable when you look at what has history told us about inflation in the U.S., right? I mean, it's been over 4% if you look over a 50 or 60 year period. But nonetheless, people are still bringing their inflation assumptions down. That 50th percentile has been at 3% for public plans, but it's starting to drop below 3. I think, Rick, didn't you guys look at something? The mean might be 2.8 something,
yeah,
now at 2.8. This point. So a lot of systems are starting to drop down to that 2.5 or 2.75% level. Okay, so slide 13, what's our sort of recommendation would be to consider a reduction to 2.75. It's closer to where the market expectations are. It's closer to where your investment consultants are. It's still not making a giant change, but it's, and I'm starting to see some investment consultants that are using a 2.5 or 2.75% assumption. So I don't think there's any reason to jump further than where sort of the investment community is. And again, the trend for public plans has been to gradually reduce that assumption over time. In slide 14, we start to talk about wage growth. We have two different components to wage growth. There's the base wage growth, right? What's going into the bargaining increases that affect all members. And then there's the individual increases, right, that each member is going to get as they go through their step increases or they get promotions. We're focusing here on the base wage growth assumption. It's inflation plus maybe some real wage growth factor. Currently, we assume that wages grow by 25 basis points more than inflation, so 3.25%. That's low historically. So why do we think that, a low assumption is reasonable? Well, you've got the budgetary environment, both over short, medium, and long term for public finance. It's in some ways not pretty. There's the political environment, and there's the fact that other areas of compensation, in particular pensions and healthcare costs, have been growing faster than inflation. So if those things grow faster than inflation, it's hard for the cash compensation part to also exceed inflation. There has been evidence that does show there has been real wage growth over time in the U.S., that wages have grown faster than inflation. But a lot of that, if you dig into the numbers, is increases in the mean amount, not the median. Well, what does that mean? That means that a lot of the increase in wages have been happening at the high end of the pay scale, which really pull up that average, right? So the mean is going to be affected by things like people working in finance and, you know, doctors or whatever that are getting really, have got great wage increases. The median is going to be affected by what's happening to everybody's wages. And what you're seeing is that the mean grows faster than the median. Where do public sector employees lie? Probably somewhere in the middle, right? Your wages are higher than median wages, but they're definitely, you're not grabbing that those people at the 1% part of the income ladder that have really pulled up the mean. So it's probably somewhere in between. Slide 16 shows this information, especially that the average wage increase has grown by 2.7 since 2002, which is 70 basis points higher than inflation, but the median has only grown by 2.3. So that's 30 basis points, which is very close to your long-term assumption. So what do we think you should do? I think you should definitely maintain some kind of a positive real wage growth assumption. There have been some relaxing of like budgetary pressures, and some of those other compensation areas like pensions and healthcare are not increasing as fast as they were 5 to 10 years ago, right? And a lot of experts, including Social Security, still think that there is going to be real wage growth. But we think that having a low assumption is still reasonable. So we would recommend maintaining that 25 basis points. You could also increase it to 50 basis points. That would be more conservative because it would increase costs and result in higher expectations of future wage growth. It would also be more consistent with a lot of your 37 Act peers. A lot of our competitors tend to use higher real wage growth assumptions of maybe 50 to 75 basis points, but we don't see a real reason to change. One other thing that's interesting is that, and this shouldn't be how you choose your assumption, right? These are long-term assumptions. But if you lower your inflation assumption at 2.75 and you add another 25 basis points to that for real wage growth, you get to a wage growth assumption of 3%. I happened to look at the most recent MOUs that are on the website for Stanislaus County, and it looks like you guys are getting 3% base wage increases over the next few years. So it's not a horrible thing that if you keep these assumptions as is and drop your inflation assumption, it turns out that your total wage growth assumption matches what's in your MOUs for the next few years. Again, we're trying to do these things based on the long term, but it's not a bad thing if the short term does, you know, tee up with those assumptions as well. Any questions on those, on inflation or wage growth? All right, I'm going to do COLAs real quick. Long story short, the increase in your COLAs should be less than the cap on the COLA, because even if inflation ends up being the same as the cap, you're going to have some good years, some low years, some high years. So imagine if you retired and COLAs were 2% for the next 5 years, and then they were 4% for the next 5 years after that. The average would be 3, right, which is the same as the cap. But what was the average increase in the COLA? It's only 2.5, because you don't build up a bank in those first 5 years, right? Your COLAs are 2% each of those first 5 years, and then the next 5 years, you're capped at 3. So you'd only get 3% in those next 5 years. So the average growth in the COLA should always be less than the cap. And we propose that if you reduce that inflation assumption from 3 to 2.75, you would reduce the COLA growth assumption to 2.6. And we did some simulations that sort of are why we have that recommendation. That offsets, right? I'm going to get to the end of the story. If you lower your discount rate, that fact that we're also lowering the COLA growth assumption would offset some of the impact on the employer's contribution and your liabilities. All right, so we did that stochastic testing. We can skip all that. 21, here's where rubber meets the road, the expected rate of return. So what do? We collect information from Verus, and then we also look at a sample of other investment consultants. We apply it to your asset allocation. They give us a correlation matrix, the volatility, you know, the variability of each of the asset classes. We model it fully. We look at administrative expenses separately. This is all supposed to be net of investment expenses. If we take Verus's long-term capital market assumptions, which you probably can't read on slide 22, and we jump to slide 23, when we do all that modeling, we got an average real rate of return of 4.43%. Add that to Verus's 2.1% for inflation, and you get to a 6.53% nominal return. Now, Verus had provided some information about their expectations. Their numbers are almost right on top of these. I think it's only off by a few basis points. So they were expecting something like a 6.5% rate of return on your portfolio as well, right? But again, that's based on 4.4% real, or real plus 2.1% inflation. We also looked at, there's a company called Horizon Actuarial Services that serves multi-employer plans. They publish a survey of a lot of the same investment consultants that you're probably familiar with, and they have 10 and 20-year horizons. So if we jump to page 25, I'm going to show you what the modeling looks like both under Verus versus these other consultants. Look at that last column, real return. So Verus's assumption or their results or our results using their model is about 4.4. Pretty similar on the Horizon survey for the 10-year number. It's about 4.3. And it's higher. It's like 4.85% based on their long-term assumptions. And they define long-term as 20 or more years. Now, what should you be looking at in terms of a time frame? Well, I know I always say that we're going to use these numbers for the next 80 years. But the bulk of your liabilities, right, the duration of the bond that is StanSara is something in the mid to high teens, right? So something probably between a 10-year and a 20-year number is appropriate. Right now your assumption is 4.25%. We should take off a couple basis points for investment manager fees for Verus and your custodian. That gets you something pretty close to that 4.25% return you're using right now for your real rate of return. Slide 26, we show some additional analysis we did in terms of the likelihood of achieving various rates of return. So the left-hand results, those are the nominal rates. So that's based on the investment consultant's inflation assumptions, not yours. What's the likelihood of achieving, 6, 7, 5, or 7%? It's less than 50-50 for the 7% number. If you look at, you average it between Verus and the Horizon numbers, it's 48%. But again, the difference there is that these investment consultants are using an inflation assumption down in the low twos, right? That's the difference between where they are and you are. So if they replaced their inflation assumption number with yours, these numbers would be greater than 50%. And you can see that in the chart on the right. So right now, your real return assumption is 4.25%. All three groups, the Verus, the Horizon 10, and the Horizon 20-year survey, all indicate a greater than 50% chance of achieving that assumption. Right? So all other things being equal, if the consultants were right on average, you would see small losses on your assets, but you would also see small gains on your liabilities because of inflation being low, and those things would offset each other. Okay? Again, more information on slide 27 about the distribution of returns, right? It's kind of silly that we're getting into discussions of, well, we think it's going to be 4.32 or 4.35 or 4, right? We're predicting these things to a hundredth of a decimal place. That's not going to happen. What's going to happen is it's going to fall within some range, and that range can be pretty wide. So what we're showing you here is based on the volatility that the investment consultants have assumed about the different asset classes, there's a 75% to 25% likelihood that that over the 10 years horizon says your portfolio will earn somewhere between 4.4% and 8.8%. Right? So there's a range to these numbers. We shouldn't focus too much on just the one, what do we think that 50th percentile is, but what do we think that the range of outcomes might be in the future. So how do we sum it all up? Page 28, I think that the current assumption is pretty reasonable, 4.25% for the real return. Verisk gives you slightly better than a 50-50 chance of making that over 10 years on a real basis, similar for Horizon, and slightly higher for them over a longer period of time. And then slightly less than the 50-50 chance on the nominal basis, but again, that's because of the difference in inflation. You would see losses on the assets, but then offset by gains on the liabilities if their assumptions are correct over the long term. So in terms of our recommendation, slide 29, there are definitely different reasonable sets of assumptions, including your current assumptions. You really need to consider your risk tolerance, right? How certain do you want to be that you're going to be able to make that rate of return? How much volatility can the plan sponsor handle? You may say, you know what, 50-50 sounds great, but I'd rather be a little more than 50-50 when it comes to being right more often than we're wrong in terms of hitting that benchmark. One good reason for that is it's harder if you're wrong, if you've missed your target, it might be harder to raise the contributions in those years for the employer, right? Because maybe something else bad is happening in the economy. But really, this is a decision about risk tolerance. You're not going to hit this assumption exactly. It's how do you want to structure it in terms of conservatism versus, you know, your best estimate. Our basic recommendation would be it's reasonable to maintain that 4.25 rate of return, real rate of return. All of the investment consultants think you have at least a 50-50 chance, and if you look over that 20-year horizon number, it's a decent amount above 50-50. We also think that if you combine that with the reduction in the inflation assumption to 2.75, then it would make sense to reduce your nominal return assumption to 7. COLA growth would go to 2.6. Wage growth would go to 3% if you maintain that 25 basis point margin between real wages and CPI. You could also consider an increase in the real wage growth assumption. Again, that would put you closer to your peers and would be a little more conservative, but we don't see a real reason for that in the data. And then the next slide, 31, and you're not supposed to make decisions based on what you think the cost and outcome is going to be. You should decide, hey, these are my best estimate of the assumptions. But because it is important information, we did cost out the impact of those different possibilities, either keeping the current assumptions, dropping inflation by 25 basis points and leaving real wage growth at 25. That's option one. And then option two is also increasing the real wage growth assumption, so wages would be growing at 3.25 like they are now. Going at the very top, all of these numbers are total contributions. These are employee plus employer. Okay, we don't have them broken out yet because calculating the employee rates takes a lot of calculations. But the baseline, if you go back to the slides we looked at earlier, if you add the employer plus the employee rate, it was about 40.75%. If we just adopt all the demographic assumption changes we recommend, right, so mortality and all that, it actually ends up reducing contribution rate in total by over 2% of pay. Again, that was driven mostly by mortality. You'll see that the normal cost changed almost none, right? It's just still 21%. That would indicate that you probably wouldn't see a big change in the employee rates because the employee rates are based on normal cost. But you would see a reduction in the employer rate of over 2% of pay. Option one, total contribution goes back up to 40.35. So relative to the demographic changes, it's an increase of 1.7%. But relative to where we started, 40.75, that would mean even if you reduce your nominal return assumption to 7, we would still expect to see a small decrease in the total contribution rate, employee plus employer. We would probably see the employee rates go up a little bit because you can see that normal cost goes up from 21.04 to 21.5. The employees might be paying something close to half of that increase. So overall, you might see the employee rates going up by somewhere around 0.25%. Again, we haven't run those calculations yet. But the employer rates would drop overall. Not by much. They'd be pretty close to where they are now. And then option two, which is to put a little bit more conservatism in the real wage growth assumption, you would see a slight increase in the total contribution rate from 47.5 to 40.93. So basically, almost a little more than offsetting the impact of the mortality and the other changes. And again, both options 1 and 2 involve a 7% discount rate down from 7.25. I've said a lot. This is where I hope to get feedback from you all in terms of how do you want us to move forward with putting together the final valuation results. And then obviously whatever you adopt would go into the experience study report as well. But again, I'm comfortable with any of those economic assumptions that we described. I do think that lowering the inflation assumption makes sense. I think it's a happy accident that that change in the return assumption is offset by the other demographic assumptions. It's really, you know, usually it's a hard decision when you're trying to lower the discount rate and you know the contribution rates are going to go up. I'm not in your shoes, but I'm guessing it's a little easier when you've already got something else in your pocket that's offsetting that increase.
So I talked with the county this morning, and in fact, Jewel's here today, and she was part of this conversation. If you'd like to say something, that would be a good time.
Okay. Thank you, Rick. It was very helpful to speak with Rick this morning in our office and get some background on all of this. We're comfortable with the reduction in the discount rate to 7% in conjunction with the inflation reduction. That makes sense. We were content to hold steady with the wage rate of 0.25. That made sense to hold, and as you noted, that you know we've pretty much completed our labor negotiations, and that fits right in currently with what our expectation is seeing, you know, the 3% over 3 years. I think we just talked briefly after our discussion with you, Rick, that anything in the future that were to go dip below that 7%, we'd want to have a discussion, maybe get a little more background and better understanding. And I know Jody had a question regarding historical versus forward-looking, perhaps a better understanding of why past experience is not the best indicator. That was a kind of, you know, where we landed after our discussion. But we were comfortable with the option 1 that you're presenting. That made sense to our office.
I mean, one thing historical versus forward-looking, one of the biggest factors is just bonds, right? The yields on bonds over the last 100 years, I don't know that number off the top of my tongue, but it's definitely more than 2, which is what you're yielding now in bonds, right? Or, I mean, government bonds.
Pretty close, yeah.
So I think one of the big reasons why you wouldn't look at just how have things done historically is that bond yields are just significantly lower than they used to be.
I think growth expectations change over time, too.
Sure.
And technological changes produce economic growth. And depending where we are on that technology curve would be a good indicator of what future growth might look like in the equity markets.
We're not seeing a lot of growth in productivity.
We're not, exactly. So that would be muted a little bit there. Yeah.
And because I'm a glass half full person, one of the reasons that people have been trimming their expectations of future earnings is because you've done pretty well over the last few years, right? Price to earnings have kept going up and up and up and up and up. Well, the last couple months have reset those prices a little bit, right? So to the extent that you have you reset to sort of a lower level of prices, well, that probably wouldn't make you want to reduce your expectations going forward necessarily, right? When should you be lowering your expectations? Probably when things have been going up and up and up and up and up and up. Now, if we've had a pause in that, and maybe in some cases, do we call it a correction yet?
It's the Trump market. I leave that day to British Jim.
All right, I'm not going there. But it just seems like that was something that the last few years have been causing people to cut their expectations of future earnings is because the market had been running up and up and up, and now maybe that's paused a little bit. That takes some of that pressure off, at least temporarily.
The Apple effect. We're not seeing the growth in Apple that we had seen for quite some time as the market became increasingly saturated with cell phones, and I think that that's actually kind of put a damper on the whole thing. You know, it was crazy there for a while.
Well, wage growth has been stagnant when you look at wage growth compared to pricing for the last 30 years. Yep. And what what I believe we found ourselves in is a situation where we're highly dependent upon borrowing rates, interest rates. And interest rates, I mean, in the last number of years have been historically low, as you pointed out. And that's made up the difference between low wage growth, prices. Those low interest rates have allowed people to still buy things and be part of this consumer-driven economy. 70% of our economy, which is unhealthy, is driven by consumer spending. So as interest rates go up and the Fed is on this move to, you know, sell off its balance sheet, I think we're in for a rocky road ahead. And so I would agree with Graham that if we're going to do it, now is the time. Now is the time to do it. So I'm in favor of option one, which is the recommendation.
Ed, do you have any thoughts? Are you still with us?
I do. I have a lot of thoughts. But I think the discussion is very much on point. I think the role of the Fed has had a huge impact and will continue to. And I think that's what Garen was just alluding to, is the unwinding of the balance sheet is kind of an unprecedented thing. And quantitative easing was unprecedented, and now what we're going to see with quantitative tightening is unprecedented as well. So it will be interesting to watch that play out. The earning picture, both domestically and internationally, actually continues to be strong. So the Apple effect is something that we're seeing in the indices, because Apple and its market cap is one of the dominant players, and so its stock price movement has had an outsized effect on the returns of the S&P 500. Other indices that aren't market cap weighted have demonstrated other results. And so I think that the point is very well taken, that that Apple effect is pretty profound on the major indices and on consumer psyches and investor psyches. But there is a lot else going on besides Apple. And so the overall earnings growth that we see here in the U.S. continues to be strong. I think we're looking, this quarter is going to be something like a 10% number, which is good. We watched the banks report earlier this month, and none of the major banks uttered the R word, recession. And so that's good news. So as much as this economic growth cycle has grown a bit long in the tooth, there's no real economic sign that we're seeing out there that says recession is on the horizon. So we have a very flat yield curve. We may potentially see it go inverted. It has gone inverted before, and that hasn't been an immediate indicator of recession. So we may be in that spell now where it's 1, 2, or 3 years off or something like that. But I think it's comforting to note that nothing out there right now is saying recession. And so I think our economic forecasts are still kind of positive but muted, and very much like what we've been seeing with, you know, GDP growth of 2.5 to 3% kind of range, and kind of keeping in that range bound mode. So I think that's the direction we're heading. That's what we're seeing as far as our tea leaves go. And the returns then, as a result to I think it was Graham's point earlier about just we're in a low interest rate environment. When you apply a building block approach, everything that builds off a low interest rate assumption is going to have low returns, and that's what we're seeing. And so we're not seeing any great returns out there to, if we go all in, you know, this, that, or the other asset class. It's going to be a blended portfolio that kind of gets us something in the 7% kind of range. So,
hey, Ed, there are still some of these economists who say expecting 6% or more earnings is nonsense, or anything over 6% for return on investment. And we're going to be at 7, which is obviously better than 7.25. But are they at all credible, those people who are saying 6% should be the cap?
That's interesting, Michael. I would probably need to read more about the reports that you're referring to. So I've seen a a lot of different prognostications out there. When it comes to earnings, when we talk about S&P 500 earnings at least, we've continued to see good forecasts through this quarter and next and throughout all of 2019. But those forecasts are coming down pretty significantly from what we saw in 2018 and 2017. So there is a slowing of the earnings growth, but we haven't seen any reversal, and I haven't seen anything that had a 6% number on it. If you're talking about a blended portfolio return of 6%, yeah, I can see that being something that people are probably questioning and challenging, because a lot of that has to do with how much you expect to get out of your bond portfolio, which seems to be pretty darn low. A lot of people are concerned that the credit markets are overextended in the high yield of bank loan space, and if there is a recession, those securities will pull back significantly. And then international, you know, there's just the whole handful of stories about what's going on in France and Germany and Brexit and China and everywhere else in Latin America. So it really just depends on what the headlines are. But if you have something and can forward it to me,
I'll do that. I'll send it over to you.
I think one thing that's important to remember too is that this number is not meant to predict the returns over the next 3 years. This is the long-term average rate of return on the portfolio over a 10-plus, 15-plus, 20-plus year time. I mean, even if you earned exactly 6% for the next 3 years, it wouldn't be the end of the world for Stansera, right? We're using five-year asset smoothing, 3 years of just not meeting your assumption by 1 year, it's not going to drive this thing off a cliff. It's also it's not going to happen. We're not going to get 6%, 6%, 6%, or 7%, 7%, 7%. We might get a minus 5 and then maybe a 15. Like, you don't know, right?
Right.
So you're not, they're not.
I get that.
Yeah, I'm just,
I get that.
So I think reasonable about your long term is, you know, a good thing to think about.
So, Graham, I like the option one, you know, when you have the luxury to cut the discount rate and not have the employer's contribution go up, that's great. My question is on the five-year smoothing, assuming we'll have a bad year, right, this year, I mean, half the year has been pretty bad. The next half, I don't know if we can recover all of it, but assuming that we don't, how much room do we have? Do we have any gains left in the five-year smoothing?
That's a great question, and the answer is yes.
I think it's like 14
if you
billion.
Look at the very slide number 2, you can see the actual value of assets and the market value of assets. The market value of assets, $4.8 million higher than the actual value of assets. So we have a little less than $5 million in deferred gains. That's not going to get you too far, but it's there.
So
the timing of each of those gains and losses later. So I can't tell you right now.
Yeah.
Next year, all things being equal, whether it be up or down, because there's one layer will drop off, but it's not big. They're pretty close together at this point.
Yeah. So they're kind of evening out.
Yeah. But it does mean that even if you have a bad year this year,
right,
you will only be recognizing 1/5 of the badness.
Correct. Yeah. Thank you.
Is our amortization rate continues to go down?
Continues to go down. At some point, we will need to have a discussion about that, right? Because you don't want that to go to 1.
Right.
Because then you would be immediately amortizing any gain or loss, so it would be very volatile.
Right.
But given where you are overall right now, you're in kind of a sweet spot where just taking it down by 1 each year is fine for right now. That's about the length of time that we would probably recommend that you amortize a gain or a loss over, right? We'd probably say amortize any gain or loss over somewhere between a 15 and 20-year period. Well, you're at 18 for the unfunded liability right now, so why complicate your amortization method at this point when it's overall, I think, on a reasonable basis?
But we are still rolling down. So
you're still coming down.
Next year will be 17.
Next year will become 17.
And I was under the impression that when we got to 15, we would stop.
That's the current policy in place. Right
so
now.
That is the current policy.
Yeah.
Most public sector entities have gotten away from using. Actually, there's recommendations out there not to use perpetual rolling amortization. especially for things like plan changes. So I think at some point you need to revisit that policy. There's actual standards of practice that are going to be coming out that we'll probably recommend against a perpetual rolling period when you've got an unfunded liability.
But
what would mean is...
Aren't we saying that we would like stabilize at 15?
What generally happens, what almost every system
layered
that I know of in the 37 Act right now uses layered amortization, which just basically means next year, if you have a gain or a loss, you'll put that over its own 15 to 20 year period.
Oh, yeah.
But I thought that we were, okay, I did think we were going to that, but I thought it was going to be 15.
I don't think, have we actually decided what that period is going to be?
When I first got here, the policy was set that they would tick it down by one each year, get it to 15, and then roll it.
Right.
But we always said that when we got close to this point, we would come back and have this discussion again.
Because we have talked about the layering
before. Right.
Yeah. Yes.
I thought we were headed that direction.
That's where we would recommend you
go. Like 15, and then we were going to start the layering, but at 15 for each of those.
I think that policy probably makes a ton of sense. If you want to put that one in right now, I'm happy to do it. The projections that we show you in the VAL
report.
So the projections that we show you in the VAL report do assume that your current UAL is going to drop to zero, that it's going to get paid off, right? That it's not going to perpetually roll.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, whatever that policy ends up being, again, I think what you I have some systems that have set that at 20 years instead of 15 for new layers, right? Gives you a little more volatility control. But again, we're happy to have that discussion whenever you want us to have it. But right now, for this year, I think your current 18-year policy is a good one.
Further discussion? I just say one thing. I'm okay with this option one. However, I think the inflation rate is going to rise rather than lower. You're doing this just at the time and inflation is going up and the Fed's raising rates, so it just seems odd to me that as inflation is rising, that we're actually lowering the assumption rate.
I think that's a great point. It was funny for me that the day after I sent this presentation, I email over your COLA letter for next year that shows the Bay Area CPI went up by like 4.5.
4.5.
But the markets still think it's less than 3.
I think the market's wrong.
I think with the control that the Fed has on interest rates, I don't think we're going to see extended hyperinflation anywhere in the future. I think an assumption at 3 or slightly below is a prudent choice right now.
I never considered 3% hyperinflation. I just look at 2.75. With the rise of inflation right now, it's unrealistic. Although, you know, for us, it probably doesn't make much difference, a quarter point. But I just was surprised to see that. I think you're wrong.
I'll make a motion to approve option one.
I'll second.
Okay, motion been made. Second it, and we approve option one. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion is carried unanimously.
Thanks, Graham.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Ed.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll drop off now, unless you need me for anything.
I think we're good. Thank you.
See you, Ed. Have a great day, everyone.
Bye, Ed.
Bye.
Okay, 8. B, do we even have, I don't have that in my packet.
Yeah, this one.
I was wondering if that was mislabeled.
Yeah, it was, sorry.
So this is the Information Technology Solutions project update. I wanted to inform the board that I've appointed Jamie to take over as project manager of that project, and most likely she will just sit in that position for the duration of the project, regardless of when we fill Don's position. So I'm going to turn this over to Jamie, and she'll let you know what's going on in the project.
All right. So as most of you know, our staff are continually working on this project every day, be it benefits or operations. We met with City of Ceres last week, and they are working diligently to get the files that we need for the upload. and they come back with questions, and they are definitely on it. In addition, the county and the courts will be sending us their first employer reporting test files in the next week. So we'll be doing some parallel testing with that. And as of this morning, Natalie did a snapshot of our 1099-R and interest posting, so that since we only do this once or twice a year, that Tegra has that information to be able to compare, to be able to move forward when we get to that in several months. Other than that, everything is rolling fine.
Okay, that item is just informational. Is that it?
Okay.
Okay. 8.C, Boardroom Committee update.
And Natalie Elliott will give us an update here.
Construction on the new boardroom has started. We are 2 weeks into it. Samples are being brought in for color selection and all that good stuff. Got a quote for the audio video system, and the quote came in over $45,000, so we had to go out for a request for bid for that. So that is in process, and that process should be final by Friday, and we should select the vendor next week sometime. So we're still on time, going strong, and if you want to take a look, peek in there after the board meeting, be my guest.
We don't have to have a park and yeah, issue.
They're not here working today, so no.
Okay, thank you for that. 8D, Executive Director Goals Update.
So this is an information item only. Generally, this is on consent, but I wanted to pull this off consent just to tell you about the progress that we made in 2018 and where we're going with this item and the next item that we'll be talking about. So nearly all the goals that we had set out at the beginning of 2018 were actually completed this year. There were four that weren't for various reasons, and I'm going to go over them very quickly here. We had on tap this year was an RFP for general counsel. The board agreed to wait until 2019 due to essentially the ongoing involvement in our legal cases. We wanted to see if that would start to wind down, so we're going to be putting that on tap for next year. There was a development of an investment manager thesis, and generally what that is we put together criteria that tells us how we should be looking at our managers in terms of performance and whether they're still doing what we hired them to do. That was on Chris's plate for the last quarter of this year, so that kind of fell off, and we will put that on 2019. The other two, peer review process and org structure, I'm going to be recommending in the next item that we push that off until 2020 and beyond. A lot of the goals for the current strategic plan were set under the assumption that the pension administration project would be done late this year or early 2020. Since we're not going to meet that goal, we stretch that out by 5 months. It makes sense to put the development of an org structure and a peer review process into the 2020 and beyond. The pension administration project is going to provide us with a lot of efficiencies that we don't fully appreciate and understand right now. And work is going to be moving around the organization in ways we don't quite understand right now. And it doesn't really seem to make sense to put together an org structure right now until we really know what we're going to be getting from this system. And the same holds true for a peer review process. Work is going to be very easily managed and tractable with a workflow process. We'll be able to tell where everything is in each of their stages. And so putting together a peer review process might be a little bit premature right now, too, as well. We are going to develop a peer review philosophy next year, but actually implementing that philosophy, we won't do that until we go live with the system. So I would say overall, I feel that we did very well in meeting our goals other than that investment manager thesis policy that we were going to get out, but that will be done in 2019. So if you have any questions on that, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions?
Okay. All right.
Great. 8E.
8E is the Executive Director Goals for 2019. This is a discussion and action item. And staff, it says none here, but we will obviously be recommending approval of these goals for 2019. So right now we're in the final year. 2019 is the final year of this current strategic plan. We actually achieved probably 80 to 90% already of the strategic action plan and objectives that were set out in 2016. So there's not a whole lot on our plate for this year. What we do have is mostly investment-related stuff regarding manager monitoring and IPS compliance. That'll be on our plate for this year. Something that's very important, developing documentation for maintaining our investment database. We have got a very, I've said this over and over, we've got a very rich investment database that we now have and maintain. The problem is, unfortunately, it's been a one-man show, and that one-man show has been me. And I need to be able to document our processes so we can hand this type of stuff over to the people that come along behind us. I know how to do it like by the back of my hand, but nobody else does right at this stage. So I think it's very, very important that we develop procedure and process to make this something that transitions over to the people that come along behind us. So that's another thing on our plates. As I mentioned earlier, we want to formalize our peer review process philosophy this year. And then another big thing that we want to accomplish this year, and we're getting ready to start on, is a redesign of Stan Sarah's website. So by the end of the year, we hope to have a nice, big, beautiful website in place. There were, like I said earlier, there were items originally slated to be completed this cycle that we're pushing off into the next strategic plan, org structure, member web portal, and workflow design. That'll all come later on in 2020 and beyond. We are having a strategic planning meeting this Thursday with the strategic planning committee, and I'll be proposing a different type of strategic plan for 2020 and beyond. We'll see where that goes, but we'll be bringing that to you probably in February or March, depending on the pleasure of the committee. So that's all I have for our prospective goals for 2019, and again, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Okay. This
Chairman,
requires a vote. To...
Chairman, I move that we adopt the executive director goals for 2019.
Second. Okay. Motion conveyed and seconded that we adopt the goals as listed in the item 8E. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carried unanimously. Pretty much agreement on everything today. Fred, do we have anything?
Sir? Not for me.
Okay, then we will go to members forum. Do you have anything?
No, I don't.
Brad?
Nope.
Kara?
Nope.
Nothing.
I'd just like to talk once again about the public administration system, the pension administration system, and how smoothly it has gone. I sit on the committee, and it just amazes me. I mean, like I mentioned today at the committee meeting, that I've been, when I was in the county, I set on a couple of different IT projects, and they really struggle and have cracked and burned. And this one is just amazing. That's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mike?
Good. Thanks.
I'm
and
good.
Pete?
Nothing.
I want to make one thing clear here, or get some guidance here on something Trustee Lynch asked to do. So you were asking that about whether we have reported out the asset allocation changes or whether we report out before we make those changes.
I think it was we all voted on the changes.
Right.
I understand that. But I had made the comment at one of the meetings, like, you're going to move huge amounts of money, and we don't know where they're going and where they're, I mean, who we are taking them from and where we are putting them in. And that's the data part I don't have.
Okay. So I do know that in the past we have told you after the fact that we have made transitional changes to the portfolio. We've moved from A to B. But we have not ever come to you and said before the fact that we were going to make those moves. But I know that Chris got into a regular routine of actually letting you know what the changes were after we had made those.
Yeah, I just want to know where we took, you know, 20%, you know, $300 million, $400 million, $600 million, who we took it from and who we gave it to.
Okay. Would you rather us put together a written document each
whichever easier for you. Okay, I'm just curious about it.
Okay. I mean, we can continue to report out orally.
I don't want to burden you guys. You and I can just meet privately. You can show it to me.
Okay.
Demi effect.
Maybe we'll put together something very quick that just shows what the activity was for the last month.
Yeah, map out how the money shifted.
Okay. But not before, right?
No, that's fine.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Unless I think you're really stupid on there.
No, it's just going to be what you guys have already agreed to anyway. That's what these transitions are all about.
No, we've agreed to the concept to go from A to B, but we haven't agreed to what's in B, picking within B.
We hope it's not hedge funds.
I'm not sure I understand what's within B.
Yeah, I mean, if, you know, just I act on the emerging markets. What emerging markets? That's what I want to know.
Okay, well, that's at a kind of a higher level. I mean, when we move from one manager to the next, we know what the manager invests in that we're going to. That's pretty much implicit because they're just going to spread it across their entire portfolio. So let me work on this. Let me work on trying to get something a little more comforting and specific to the transitions that are made. Okay.
And I plan on going to New Orleans for a seminar next month, so I won't be here for the next month's meeting because happens at the same time as this meeting.
I hope you were paying attention.
It's all on audio.
So you can be the chairman for life.
That's right.
I mentioned I won't be here next month either.
I won't either.
You might want to go to New Orleans too.
I
won't be here either.
I know, so it's just.
I'll be here.
All right.
I can just follow up later if I'm going to be here.
All right.
How many? We know at least three are not going to be here out of nine. Unless you're not going to be here, then we may have changed the meeting date.
We could meet in New Orleans. As long as we notice it.
Oh, boys on you.
You're going to be here?
It's like I'm here.
Okay, you're it then next month. Okay, this meeting stands adjourned.
Thank you.